Hello, and welcome to Season 3 of Medical Women Talking. I'm Jane Dacre, and in this season, I wanted to speak to more wonderful and inspiring medical women, including people who are early and mid-career. These women are all making a name for themselves in their respective fields. They're what I like to call rising stars, and will be influencing all our futures.
Hello, today I'm talking to Razia Shah. Razia's a locum consultant in women's health. She's active in medical research and education, but perhaps more remarkably, she's also the mother of four children. Razia, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for asking me.
So Razia, I'd like to start, if I may, with you just giving us a summary of how your career started. When did you decide to become a doctor, for example?
During secondary school and particularly sort of in year 10 and 11, I was actually really struck by physics and astrophysics, and I thought I really want to be an astrophysicist. I had a life-changing event in that my father passed away, and this was the February before the GCSEs, and we went to Pakistan because Pakistani elders usually like to be buried in their homeland. So
your family are from Pakistan, aren't
yes,
they?
Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah. So as a family, we went to Pakistan. We had the burial, the funeral, and that was sort of the February, March time, just before GCSEs. And I just was struck by the poverty, the women's situation, at 15, I didn't really understand very much, but I thought actually to thrive in this sort of society and act as a bridge between my British heritage and my Pakistani heritage, astrophysics is probably not going to cut it. And the thing that will unite people is something like medicine, where you can be a doctor pretty much globally and anywhere. So that's what planted the seed. And then obviously, because I was excelled at science, I took science A-levels, but I made sure I took ones that would get me into medicine. And then it went from there. So I had fairly 360-degree change over that couple of months.
Oh, gosh. So then you came back, did your A-levels, and then went straight to medical school?
No. So I did my A-levels. I applied to medical school. I got one interview and completely failed at that interview. I just, I'd not been used to it. It was nothing like I'd done before. Doing medicine from the background I was from, because I grew up in a deprived northern mill town, amongst almost sort of 95-99%, I would say, immigrant community. Going to medicine was pie in the sky, and then doing that as a woman was just even more radical. So
did you have any doctors in your family?
No,
what
not at all.
Your parents, what did your family members do?
So my father, how he came to this country actually was is really interesting, and he's probably my inspiration for most things in life. So he came from a quite well-off background, but he, for some reason, from his teens, had this burning desire to be independent. So while his brothers just took on jobs in the family village and just sort of supported the family system, my father really wanted to be independent. And even as young as 14, 15, had left school, was working. There was no job that was too low for him. He was just would work the land. He'd gone to Karachi, which is a city at that time. Even now, you know, is 24-hour drive from where his family come from. He ended up in this port working on merchant ships. He got on a ship, and then once they docked in the UK, he got off.
A friend of him. Where was that? Where did he get off?
I think it was Hull.
Really? Amazing.
And then a friend of his encouraged him to not go back to the ship. And so he just spent some time floating around the UK. And then Maggie Thatcher, bless her, she declared an amnesty. So if you were in the country without any papers, you could, not that I'm encouraging anybody to do this, but this
was
is...
He was without papers, was
he's
he?
He's without papers. So you know, there was lots of people, you know, sort of struggling across the world who would come to the UK as economic migrants. He wasn't, he was just, you know, one adventure after the other. And so he came through, and then Maggie Thatcher, she announced the amnesty, and he went forward, and a lot of his friends said, don't, it's a trap, they're gonna deport you, but that's how he ended up with British citizenship. And then he brought my mum over in 1975, and they settled in a town called Burnley in Lancashire, because it was very, very green and it looked like home. And that's where I grew up. And that in that community, which was very close knit, like I say, my dad was quite progressive in his thinking. So even as children, he would say to us, you know, you need to be independent, you need to get your education, you know, so you don't have to. In fact, his very words were, so you don't have to rely on any man. You can, you know, when you get married, if you're, you know, not happy, you can just at least be independent and have your skills, your education, even though. Paradoxically, he didn't actually get an education himself. So he was literate, and he had sort of a, I'd say, early secondary school education. But it's something he aspired to and something that he recognised the value of.
Gosh.
Yeah.
So how many siblings did you have?
So I'm one of six girls, and we had one brother. Mm-hmm.
All one boy and six girls.
Yeah.
Poor boy.
Poor boy. Yeah. So traditionally, you know, at that time particularly, people's income in Pakistan came from their boys. So they were very keen on having boys. So my sister was born, and then my brother was born. And then I used to joke with my mum when she was alive, bless her, that the rest of the five of us were five attempts at a boy. but she absolutely adored us. And again, she'd had, you know, some education and was literate, but not beyond secondary school. So for our family, my brother had gone to university because they were both very keen on education. And then as a teenager, we moved to East London, and that really opened up a lot of opportunity for me, took us out of that sort of community where they didn't really encourage a lot of girls, and then allowed me to sort of flourish in my education and also have my pick of universities as well.
So when you were in Burnley, you were more in a sort of local Pakistani style community, were you, which broadened out in it when you came to London and went to a mixed.
Yeah, absolutely. Sort of mixed faith. Yeah, that would be very accurate. So in those northern towns, for whatever reason, communities really segregated, and Burnley is home to British National Party. It's quite active in Burnley, with a member of parliament in the BNP as well. So although there was never really much trouble that I witnessed, because there literally would be segregated communities within the town, so the Pakistanis and the Bangladeshis, the Muslim community, would tend to stick to one part of town, and the white Caucasian would tend to stick to another part of town. There was a little bit of mixing, but not a huge amount.
Do you think has that changed now? Or
yes, I think so, definitely. It's much. I've actually come full circle. I went via East London, Luton, East Anglia, and Australia, all the way back to Burnley. So I've just moved back to Burnley.
Oh, wow.
It has
changed. Different. Yes. Like you're probably different too, I suspect.
Yes, absolutely.
So you then, where did you go to medical school?
So my medical school is also interesting. Like I alluded to earlier, I went to my one interview coincidentally at UCL.
Oh dear.
And I was just completely overwhelmed, because I had spent a couple of years in East London, but you know, coming from that very segregated community that was quite poor, that was not really, and then coming into the bright lights of London and then sitting in a giant boardroom in UCL with, I can't remember, three or four very stern looking doctors at one end of this huge table, I couldn't interview. So, I've been described as a bully in a china shop before. When I'm a bit stressed, it was just trying to get to the end of that interview and get out of that room. And so, unfortunately, I had a rejection from them. And then that followed. I hadn't heard from any of my other university choices, but suddenly there was a sort of four or five rejection letters without even interview. So I thought, OK, what am I going to do? And I thought, I don't really. One quality that I have, whether it's good or bad, is once I've decided something, that's it. I'm wondering how I'm going to get there rather than stepping back from it. And so I spoke to my chemistry teacher at school and at college, and she sort of discouraged me and said she didn't think that, you know, it was worth taking a gap year and applying, and she thought I should utilize the year properly. And I was just very pig-headed, and by that time, because my father had passed away, and it's a very common theme for Pakistani families to like their children to go into medicine. And that's because I think traditionally, you know, there's not a lot of occupations in sort of the remote rural areas, but they see the doctor as somebody who's on a bit of a pedestal, got a good status, can help people, can really sort of be that sort of link across all parts of the community. So they really sort of admire the doctor. So one of the things he had said to me while he was alive is, you know, get your studies and get your grades so you can be a doctor. Although while he was alive, never actually thought about it. I was sort of in my world of astrophysics. So when he'd passed away and I'd got my A-levels and I was doing okay and I'd actually managed to get one interview, I thought, well, it wasn't a complete loss. Let's take the gap year and see what happens. And then I spoke to them about, I think I casually just mentioned what happened in my GCSEs. And they jumped on that and said, oh, you know what, we need to write a personal statement that illustrates all of that. I hadn't recognised the significance of it.
Your school said that?
Yeah, so my college tutors. Yeah. So that, I think, made a difference because I hadn't recognised that my father dying sort of 3 months before I sat my GCSEs and then missing six weeks or so of education while, you know, we went to Pakistan and that whole few, and that obviously impacted my GCSE grades. And so, you know, and does speak volumes about what sort of person you are, that, you know, you've had a life-changing event, but you've still managed to achieve, you know, respectable GCSE grades and that you've gone on to do your college education. So I decided also at the same time to resit my A-levels to try and just improve the grades a little bit more, because a lot of universities at that time were asking for 3 A's, and I think I had an A and 2 B's. So I thought, well, if I try and improve the grade and I just get a little bit more life experience and go back to them, maybe I'll get some interviews this time. And so when I took that gap year out, I then got an offer at Queen Mary University. So it was Barts in the London at the time. And the interview mostly consisted of just talking about me and my heritage and my background and where I'd been, what I'd done in that gap year. And I walked out there thinking, oh, gosh, well, that was nothing to do with medicine, no questions to do with medicine. I don't think I'm going to get in there. So I went back, and then on the morning that I was due to resit my A-level exams, I had a letter saying that I had an unconditional offer from Barts in the London.
Wow. Yeah. So you still went on and reset your exams, though?
No, I went to the I went to the exam hall and I phoned them and I said, I don't want to do this anymore. And they said, OK, then fine, we'll cancel it and we'll give you your old grades back. So,
fantastic. Yeah. So you went to Barts in the London. How was that?
It was really interesting. Lots of people at the time said, no, you should try for a more red brick university, and or, you know, because I'd obviously applied to Imperial, to UCL, and they were seen to be a bit more highbrow than Barts and the London, particularly, you know, if you just looked at London universities, Barts and the London was viewed as sort of the lower rung. But I think it suited me perfectly. So when I decided to take the gap year on the grapevine, another girl who I'd been to secondary school with, who I knew, but I wasn't a close friend of, who also went to the same sixth form as me, she heard I was taking gap year, and she'd always wanted to do medicine. She never got in, same as I did, the first application. And when she heard I was doing gap year, she said later, because we both met on the first day of university, because we both got into Barts and the London, she said, when I heard that you were going to take a gap year, I rejected my offer to do pharmacy and I decided to do a gap year and try again. And we both got into Barts. Yeah. And yeah, so it was, I just feel like it was destiny. And Barts is very much, I can identify with. It's a very multicultural community. It's very ethnically diverse. There was lots of opportunity to kind of get involved with a lot of things. And it was East London. Yeah,
I love Barts, actually. I think it's got a really lovely, welcoming, inclusive culture, surprisingly, because it's meant to be one of the old style places. But and I completely agree with you. So then medical school went through all right. Any issues, any barriers, or it was all sailing?
It was fairly plain sailing. Because I was a girl in a Pakistani Muslim community, I had, you know, my mum, bless her.
Did you live at home? Did you live
at
home?
I did. Yeah. So moving out would have been, I think, difficult for my mum, because as a single Muslim woman of, you know, sort of early, late teens, early 20s, the community probably wouldn't have, you know, sort of looked on it favourably, that I was a single girl living out on my own. And we happened to live in Leytonstone, just at the edge of Stratford, which sort of made it a 25-minute commute. So it was very doable. So that's, you know, I know a lot of people want to move out to uni for the experience, but I think my mum, being from the traditional background that she was from, she was much happier that I was at home. So
when you were at university, you didn't sometimes... young adults reject the views of their parents a bit, but that wasn't something that you...
No. In college, sort of the latter part of college, I'd started to become a bit more spiritual. And so I decided to opt to do a full covering, sort of hijab and mostly a burqa on, whereas my mother didn't do that. And so she found it actually a little bit, like, you know, a little bit extreme. So I just found, I think partly my father passing away, I found sort of solace in faith. And so that sort of carried on through my sort of young adulthood. So I sort of went the other way rather than, if you see, finding independence. I guess maybe it was because we were so independent in other aspects of life. So, you know, my college application I did by myself without any help from anybody. I'm looking back, I just wonder how on earth I did it. I filled in the UCAS, did the personal statement with no help from home, because they didn't know what I was doing. They had no sort of inkling. And my mum, bless her, you know, she spoke a little bit of English, broken English, but she was far from sort of competent with the education system. And so, you know, I look back and I think, how did I do it? But somehow I managed to get
somehow
through all those applications.
And what stage? So you went through medical school without any problems. At what stage did you get married? Tell me about that.
My mum had gone to Pakistan. And some people had approached her for my hand in marriage. And at that point, I wasn't in medical school. I was still at college. I was about 18. And she came back with a proposal, and which she, I think as a widow, she had felt a bit pressured to kind of almost half accept because, you know.
Well, she had a lot of you to offload.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So when my father was passed away, four of us were still unmarried at home. And it's quite a task. An Asian wedding, pulling off an Asian wedding is quite a task. There's lots of tradition involved, lots of sort of gift buying and several days to plan. And as on her own as a widow, you know, it must have been really, really daunting. So she'd sort of been pressured into this, and I for some reason just said, no way, we're not doing it, Mom. There were what they call public call offices. That's how you phone to Pakistan. It was just cheaper than using your BT phone line. And I remember going with her and standing outside the door while I supervised her saying no to these people that she'd sort of half promised that she would come back and that she would, you know, sort of that we would talk about it and that it was almost a done deal. So when it came up at home, I said, no way, Mom, because I'd seen my older sister. She'd been engaged for some time. She was 4 years older than me. She wasn't married, but there seemed to be a lot of sort of discussion with them about what she could and couldn't do. And my brother and my dad, bless them, they were very much pro women's rights and education. And like I say, the majority of the Pakistani community at that time weren't. And I said, well, you know what? I've got ambitions. I want to go to medical school and I want to do this. And I don't want somebody else getting involved in the decisions. I want just, this is what I'm thinking internally. So to Mom, I was like, just no way. We'll just see what happens with uni and see what happens. So I literally almost didn't quite frog march her, but I definitely supervised
that
call.
But you did get married in the end. So yes. How did that happen?
So I did get married. I got engaged quite late in medical school. And again, as a Muslim Pakistani woman, I wanted to, I guess this is the reason as well that I chose medicine, is I wanted to have a bridge between the two communities. And whilst I saw the attraction of having a love marriage with somebody I'd met, I saw a lot of my friends getting involved in love marriages, and it didn't seem to be any more successful than an arranged marriage. And I knew that that was what my mum would prefer. So we had a semi-arranged, so we sort of met in the middle. And we had a friend of a family who was introduced through my brother-in-law. And then we ended up, you know, being fairly compatible, and the families were very happy about it. And I wanted to get married to somebody from Pakistan, because I thought if I marry someone from Pakistan and they've got links to Pakistan, I will maintain that part of my heritage. Whereas I'd seen people who'd all grown up in this country and then they had no reason to go to Pakistan or to visit or to maintain that tie. And one of my motivations for becoming a doctor was to help that Pakistani community as much as I could, because I'd seen the poverty, I'd seen the way that the health system was, and I just had a desire to try and effect some change in some small way in that community as well as my British community and British life.
So your husband then came over to live in this country after
he did, bless him. I mean, at the time I sort of said it would be a small sacrifice and we'd come over for a small time, but one thing leads to another, and so I just wanted to get my specialization done, and then I thought, well, we can live between the two countries. So he came over in 2007, but we actually went for a short time to Australia. So after we got married, we went to Australia, and then spent 6 months doing A&E in Australia, which was really lovely, but it was just so far from home, so far from the UK, so far from Pakistan. So, and I'd gotten pregnant. So I decided that actually I needed a bit more community around me. And so we both came back to the UK.
Okay. And is your husband a doctor?
No, he is in IT.
Okay.
So he did struggle to adjust a little
bit. He's happy now to stay in the UK.
Yeah. So now that I've done my CCT and got a bit more time, and also along the journey as well, parts I was low coming and had a bit more freedom in terms of time. So we've always frequently gone to Pakistan, and I've always maintained ties with Pakistan because I want the children to also know why they look like the way they look like, the language that they speak, and also just appreciate, you know, how people in the developing world live.
So tell me about your children. You've got four children?
Yeah. So I have my eldest, Hania, she's 15. She's just starting to do her GCSEs. And then I've got a 12-year-old, Aisha, who we found out a couple of years ago was had acquired deafness. So she has a genetic mutation. So with her, we've gone through a little bit of, she needed cochlear implants and then the rehabilitation with her. And then I have Meher, who's 10, and she has mild autism. But she's just brilliant. And then I'd had the three girls, and I was doing medicine. I was doing locum medicine, and I'd gone into I'd applied for a training number in obs and gynae, and I got my number. And then I found out I was pregnant with Meher, the 10-year-old. And it was a surprise pregnancy, so not planned, but appreciated. And at that point, I just thought, oh, I'm not sure what to do now. So I just delayed my number by a year, and then, you know, made sure that I had a very reliable contraception after that. And then I had my three girls, and we were going through my training, and my husband was really supportive, and I managed to do that. And then at about 65, I thought, I'm getting older and I really want a boy. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to try just before it's too late. And then I got pregnant. And so when Meher was about 5, got pregnant. And then the year later, we had our little boy.
Oh, so, how lovely. So how old is he now?
He's 4.
Oh, very nice. So you've got quite a handful at home.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned there, I just wanted to mention that the challenges we've had in terms of their health, because having 4 healthy children is one sort of scenario, but having children with sort of challenging you know, health problems has added a layer of complexity to managing things at home. And I just want to, if there's people, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there. I mean, I just from discussing with my colleagues and things, you know, people do have these hurdles, and just to sort of reassure people and say, actually, you can do this and you can balance it with your career, even if you've, you know, life throws you a few sort of curveballs.
So, I mean, remarkably, you've got your CCT now. So tell me what you're up to now.
So I had when I was training, when the start of my training, I'd picked East Anglia because the, you know, the hospitals were sort of within a good commuting distance of London, and everybody, my family lived in East London. I'd moved out because it was cheaper to live outside than it was in East London. But by the time I'd finished my training, my mother had passed away and my brother had passed away. What, 2 of my sisters had moved to Pakistan. One of my sisters had got divorced and she had moved to Indonesia. So I've sort of found myself pretty much on my own in East Anglia. And then my sister, who'd gone to Indonesia, moved back, but she moved back to Lancashire. So I thought, actually, you know what? I want to move back to Lancashire. With 4 children, and my husband doing his job in IT and me doing my job as an NHS, which would now be a consultant, I wanted to go somewhere that I felt was more child friendly, open, sort of green, and also where I could afford more house for my money, basically, so that, you know, that the children would have a nice space to grow up in at half the cost in terms of housing. So I found myself back in Lancashire. And along my journey, I'd got involved in a lot of clinical research. It was a good alternative to doing locum work in hospital because it was less physically demanding. And it was actually giving me new skill sets. So I got to know a lot about how trials were run. And so when I was in Ipswich, I happened to just come across an advert on LinkedIn. I was looking for remote investigators. So I was doing that from home. And then they came back and said to me, would you like to do something a bit more substantial with us? So I've taken that on just so that I can facilitate a move 250 miles across the country, gather my thoughts about where I want my consultant job to be in terms of settling down somewhere and how I want that to look. And also I want a bit of time and a little bit of a break to be a mother, because training takes its toll on you know, on your children, on your partner and on yourself. So I'm just taking a little bit of a breath at the moment before I decide where, you know, where I can do my consultant work.
But so how are the children getting on with the move?
So they really enjoyed the move because they're closer to some cousins and things. The year before, the last year of training, we'd actually moved to Ipswich, which is 100 miles away from where we'd been living before. So they hadn't really put down roots in Ipswich. So they were happy with that. And they're just enjoying having me a bit more at home. Because I'm working from home at the moment and then doing some support work in my local sort of Lancashire teaching hospitals. So the age old story, they're quite short on staff. So I'm just sort of keeping my clinical skills up, but I'm also developing my research skills. And because I'm at home, I can be a lot more around for the children.
And you were saying you're not quite sure then what your next step's going to be.
So when I did the course, the Emerging Women Leaders course, I learned a lot of really valuable things. One of them was to stick to my guns, was to do what I wanted to do, even if it was off the beaten track. And I thought that was a theme that ran through almost everybody's story. The other theme that ran through everybody's story was never to say no to anything. Happily, that's been something that I've never done. So I've never said, if I've seen an opportunity come up, I haven't thought, how on earth am I going to put this and fit this in on my plate? I've just thought, you know what, I'm going to do it because it's valuable for me. So in my training, I've been an IMG lead for Health Education England, and I did a lot of work with IMGs, and I'm still in touch with a lot of people who are in that space and who are interested in helping IMGs, because that's one of my things that's close to my heart. I volunteered to do some SBA writing with the college, and from that, I've now lectured on their part one course, and I'm a regular facilitator on their course. I've written lots of questions for the College Bank and hope to hopefully I will apply probably for one of the committees to become a tenure to write some questions for the exams and try and support people that way. And the thing that's close to my heart is global health. And this is the thing that I've discussed with my Action Learning Set about how would I get into global health from an NHS career. And so I'm applying to do some mission work.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
So where would you go in Pakistan?
What I did when I went to Ipswich is I put my daughter in online school. So it's a remote school. So the oldest as an experiment to see if it would be good and if it would be useful and if it would satisfy her needs to be educated. And it worked really well. So Aisha, who I mentioned earlier, was deaf. She's also in the same online school now. So we pretty much could go anywhere that they're happy to send us. So,
wow.
Yeah. So I'm hoping
it is remarkable how distance learning and remote learning helps women. Yeah. I think a lot of people talk about, oh, you miss out by not being in the office. But for women who need to work flexibly, I think it's really helpful, isn't it? So we're coming to the end now. So How has been an up-and-coming, a rising star woman influenced your personal life? Is thing one.
I think I didn't recognise I was a rising star until I did your course, to be fair.
Well, I think you are.
I just have been somebody who sees the value in everything. So I was just talking to somebody who's recently CCT'd over about sort of 30 miles away from here. She was saying how, you know, she'd rather work there because the pay rate was better and so she didn't have to spend so much time away from her children. But I said, but she's doing a registrar post. And so just as an example, I was just saying, well, yes, it is a commute for me. It takes me about 45 minutes to get here and I need to book a hotel while I'm here because obviously I've got to be within a 30-minute sort of on-call distance. But the value is that I'm now gaining experience that I never had before as a consultant. So I think, you know, whatever opportunity came to my email inbox, I've always seen the value of doing that. And because I've seen the value in it, I've always enjoyed it. And so, you know, it's almost like the stuff that I did with the IMG or with the question writing, it didn't feel like work because I viewed it in a way that I thought, well, actually, this is really enjoyable. It's a good skill set. And look how many people I can help, particularly with the IMG stuff.
If you do have to go away for a night or whatever, who looks after your children? Who?
Oh, my ever suffering husband.
Is it your husband and your family? So
yeah,
that's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, my husband's been really supportive. Yeah.
So, just two quick things, because otherwise we're going to run out of time, is what inspires you? And then also, what advice would you give to younger women like you who are coming through? So just two quickies, quick fire.
So the inspiration, I would say, is women like yourself. I always, before doing the course, I always assumed that people who didn't look like me must have had an easier time of it, but it was a real eye-opener. And so all those women who've got into leadership positions, who've actually just gone against the grain and done it, those are my inspirations. Actually, you know what, just get on, roll your sleeves up and do it and you will get there.
Brilliant. And what about advice for somebody coming through who's like you?
I would say don't say no to anything, because there's always value in everything that you do. So the one where I said yes to doing these 8 p.m. 2 hours long sessions to hash out questions led to me being on a panel to write a curriculum, led to me being a part one facilitator, lecturing on an international course, going on international conferences. So opening one door can just lead to so many more. So, and I think that is in common with all the queens that you've interviewed on your previous podcasts. That for me is a recurring theme. I mean, obviously, you know, you have to balance things personally for you, but if you initially don't see the value in something, there usually is pretty extensive hidden value in these things.
Fantastic. So you're definitely one of my rising stars, Sir Razia. Thank you so much for talking to me today and good luck with it all. I'm going to look out for you. I'm sure our paths will cross several times in the future with you going onwards and upwards. So thank you so much for talking to me.
No problem. Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to Medical Women Talking with me, Jane Dacre. If you wish to hear more conversations with medical women, then check out the other seasons of this podcast series. And thank you for listening.